From Calvary Church of Santa Ana, this is the Calvary Life Podcast, the show where we share stories, tell jokes, and have discussions about faith, life, and God with people from Calvary Church. Here are your hosts, Eric and Matt.
Okay, welcome to another Calvary Life Podcast episode. My name's Eric Wakeling, and we are on the road again, right?
Yes, I'm Matt Davis, and we have a very special guest. She's come all the way from Kitale, Kenya. Will you say hello?
Hello, my name is Patricia Sao.
There we go.
But the people, most of the people of Calvary don't know your actual name, right? They know your other name.
Ah, yeah, people call me Mama Sweetie.
That's right.
Mama yes. Sweetie. Yes. So we will get into that and all kinds of other great questions about what you're doing and how God has used you. But let's go way back to the very beginning. You were born in Kenya. Tell us what life was like. Where were you born in Kenya? What was your growing up situation?
Well, I was born in a small village called Rapogi. It's small indeed. And my mother was... you know, a woman, the first wife of a man who had around seven wives.
Okay.
Yeah. And so she wanted to protect her children so much. So I was brought up in this setup where my mom wanted all her children to go to boarding schools. So I went to boarding school as young as in grade five, fifth grade.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, wait, can we interrupt for a second?
Like, yeah.
Because I think for maybe people that are listening to this, the whole thing of seven wives is probably very much like, wait, what? And but that's very common, right? In Kenya, especially then.
Then, those yeah. days, that was something that was very common in Kenya, but not all tribes. It depends.
Okay.
Yeah. There are tribes that marry many wives. There are tribes that don't.
Now, was your mom in a more as the first wife? Was she in a place of honor because of that, or not so much?
Well, the culture promoted them to accept the other wives.
Okay.
So at the in that they looked at her as somebody was welcoming.
Okay.
Okay. But really inside she was hurting.
All right.
Yes.
And the fact that she wanted you to go to boarding school represents what? If you go to boarding school, then what happens for you in your life later on?
I think she was kind of trying to shield her children from seeing what she didn't want us to see. Hmm. Trying to protect us and trying to give us the best because education was the best that he could give us as her children.
Got it.
The better educated, the better you'll go away from the tradition and all that. Hmm. Yeah.
Now, what's the difference between, and it's still a thing today, were you treated any differently as the daughter of your mother versus any brothers that you would have had? How are boys and girls treated differently? And then even all the way up to adults, how are women treated differently today in Kenya?
Well, that also depends on what part of Kenya somebody's coming from, what tribe they're coming from. It's different. Cultures cut across, different from place to place. My own father was so... As much as he married many wives, he loved his daughters so well, so much. He wanted his daughters to be up there. You know, he preferred the girls. I really don't know why, but I think that depends on which culture somebody's coming from.
Yeah.
The tribe that I come from, as much as they would marry many wives, they kind of have a love for the girl child.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I prefer my daughters as well. But I also don't have any sons.
But at the same time, it's funny because at the same time, women were treated badly for not having sons. Mm. And I think that is the one reason why my father married many wives, because my mother had girls, more girls than boys.
Okay.
So as you were growing up and you're in this home, what's your religious practices? Did you grow up in is this a Christian home? Did you guys go to church? Was there nothing?
That is the funniest part of it. We went to church.
Okay.
Allow me not to mention the denomination.
Okay.
But we went to church and our house, my mother's house, was the altar. Every evening, every child of my father came to our house to have the evening devotions. And the funny part is that Dad would sleep as we go through the prayers. There were books that we prayed with. Dad would be snoring and we are praying.
That sounds like church on Sunday.
Yeah, I mean, not much is different from
or my talk last night.
Yeah.
Okay, so I mean, there's definitely culturally a big difference, and that would be the Christian church. The altar is right there inside of your home growing up.
Yes.
How does that look different from the church today?
Well, you know that there's a big difference between religion and church.
Yes. Yes. How would you describe that difference in Kenya?
I would describe what we used to do as religion.
Okay.
Just a denomination that somebody has brought you in and taught you some prayers that you just recite, and it's not something that is from within. It's not a real relationship between somebody and God, but just being in a denomination or being in a religion for the purposes of having a social kind of prayer network or something. Yep. I really don't know how to explain it, but I think that is what it was. It was not a meaning relationship with God, but kind of a social, do I call it club or place?
Yeah. No. Yeah.
Yeah.
We get that. Mm. That can happen. That happens here in the United States, and we see that all over the place. So did you grow up, was your hope that you would be one wife to a man who had many wives? Did you got married at some point? How did all of that turn out?
The funniest thing is that when I was growing up, I kind of, now I'm going to tell you the denomination I was in, I preferred to be a nun.
Than
to go outside there and face life.
Got it.
I wanted to just grow up and be a nun. Hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
But you didn't become a nun.
Yeah, why not?
My love for children, I think I loved children so much, but this is how it happened. There was a Maurice Cerullo campaign in the town where I was.
Now say that again.
A Maurice Cerullo campaign.
What is that? I don't know what that means.
It was a campus crusade campaign.
Okay.
Got it.
Yes. And so I was in this convent school, and in Form 2, you go out. Then those days, you'd go out when you are in 10th grade, and when you come back, you choose whether to remain in the convent, never to go out again. And so
how old are you now then in this story? What grade?
I'm in grade 10.
Oh, okay.
Grade 10, high school.
Yeah,
okay.
Yes. And so we go out in the market, and there is this crusade, and they are preaching, and they're talking about being born again. And for the first time, the scripture was kind of so real. I'd never had such kind of preaching.
Yeah.
And I signed up, just not knowing. I signed up, and I'm thinking, this is good. We were given some booklets, and I'm thinking, this is good. When I go home, I must tell my mother this. We are going home for the last time. We are not coming back again. But then when I went home, nobody was going to welcome this new religion. You are born again. What is being born again? And all that. But thanks to God, God has his own ways of doing things. Yeah. My mom became sick, and all things work for good for them that love the Lord and are called according to his purposes. You know, her sickness led me not into going back to the school where I was.
Got it.
So left home, she left home, went for treatment, and I remained with my stepmother. And kind of, it seemed as though I was not going to go to school. But my elder sister called me to stay with him, with her in Mombasa. He lived at the coast. So I moved from home, moved from the convent school, and the convent thing ended up that way.
Do you think I know God could have done something else, but if your mom had not gotten sick, you would have become a nun?
Well, I know for sure, maybe if I became a nun, I could have maybe dropped out.
Right, right.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
I don't think I could have lasted there.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay, so then what happens next?
You get married at some point.
Yes, I did.
I hope she meets someone first, but yeah. Well, or else she is a nun and she's just married to Jesus.
That's right. Well, and then I think some people, we have some ignorance here. Like, what was your marriage arranged? Did you pick the person that you married? What is all? How did that happen?
Actually, he did pick me. I didn't pick him, but he picked me. It was not an arranged marriage. I know that many people think in Africa, marriages are arranged.
Right.
He picked me.
Okay.
I was not, I don't know how to talk about myself, my childhood really. I never had girlfriends.
Okay.
But I was a girl who walked among, I moved easily with young men than ladies. Okay, my friends were young boys.
Yeah.
And so I was in this group of, huge group of around 13 young men. And we were just posted. We had just been employed by the government and posted into a new town. So we are in a bus going to our deployment town. And he's among these people and we're just chatting and we are making friends and we are so excited going to this new town and we are young people and we're just freshly employed. So I just became friends with all these people. We were two girls among around 13 boys. And so we are friends and we are just buddies, just working together, eating lunch together. And so one evening we were in his house and I went to wash utensils. He cooked and we ate. And so I'm washing utensils as if these other people are talking stories. And people went one by one without me knowing that they were going. Even my girlfriend, the girl that I was with, left. And when I went back to the living room, he was all alone. And I said, "Where is everybody?" He said, "They've just gone." And I asked why. And he said, "By design." "By design? What do you mean by design?" And he says, "Okay, we just need a time to talk." Uh-huh. And I'm like, "Talk what?" And he says, "I just want you to know that I'm thinking every now and then I've looked at you." We'd been together for like a whole year.
Okay.
Just sitting, talking. We're just friends.
Just friends, yeah. Okay.
Yes. And so he surprises me by saying, "You know, I think you will be my future wife." And I'm thinking, people don't just marry. You just don't look at somebody and say, "You want to marry." I'm going home. And so he escorted me to my house, but at least he passed the message that I've been looking at you. And so the relationship just began like that.
And were you were you happy? Were you excited about that? Or were you confused at first? Or, you know?
Well, I didn't expect
enough
that.
Said.
I didn't expect that somebody would date me from the same group.
Yeah.
But I'd seen the way he treated any man that moved around me.
Oh.
And I knew this guy is into something, because whenever any man tried to kind of seduce me, he came up with things. He said, "No, he's a married man." You know, unfortunately, for sure, the two people that had come across and he kind of looked at with bad eyes were married guys. So, yeah.
But eventually.
Yes.
Eventually, we became friends. We dated for like 1 year.
Uh-huh.
And we moved in. We didn't do any wedding. We just moved in. We just sat one day and say, "Why are we wasting money? You are paying rent. I'm paying rent. What are we doing?" And we moved in.
And is that called marriage? Did you get married?
Yeah.
Okay.
After that, he arranged to go and see my parents. He went, and in our culture, there is you have to speak to the, you have to ask the mother.
The mother?
Yes.
Not the father.
The mother.
Okay.
Yeah. So she had to plan a trip to my village to go and ask my mother and pay some money to my mother, which they say a consent. My mom had to give a consent.
Okay.
So that he may begin to talk about me. So my mom gave the consent, and then later on he came back and they negotiated the dowry, paid the dowry, and we were set.
Wow.
Yeah.
So then where's life go from here?
The first 3 years of my marriage were very exciting. Mm-hmm. Having been brought up in a polygamous family, and my husband was also brought up in a polygamous family. His mother was a first wife of many other wives. And so he didn't want polygamy at all. And we thought to ourselves, we were just the right match to people who hate their backgrounds. And so we were thinking we were going to raise our children in a very different way of life.
Yeah.
They were not going to see what we saw when we were growing up, and we wanted this super family that nobody ever imagined. We were imagining it ourselves. And so we gave birth to our firstborn in a very loving environment. He was helping me care for the baby, doing all the sorts of things that a person who loves their wife can do, changing the diapers and all that. But that was not amazing to his brothers and sisters. His brothers and sisters who came to live with us didn't like it at all. And they took the message back at home. He's not married. She's married. She's married her. She's married him. He's doing everything, like giving her breakfast in bed. And so we gave birth to our second born. And with our second born, my own cousin said that I was bragging that my husband does everything. And I don't know how much that got into him. And that was kind of a turnaround in our marriage. He said he wanted to be the real man, and that the real man does not do the things that he's been doing. Mm. He was still, he didn't know that what he's doing is not the right thing. And at that point, I thought my mother's life was turning. My life was going to be like my mother's life.
Yeah.
And so it was a painful moment. It was not something good. But that is the point where I met Jesus. It was in 1989. Mm. I first went to my sister, my elder sister, to just let her know that my marriage was not working. And as we were chatting with my sister, his son, who is now a pastor and was in university then and was in the Christian Union, was listening to us just as we were chatting. And I'm telling my sister how my marriage is not going to work. I'm not lucky. And so this young man brings me a Bible, a red Bible, I still remember. Mm-hmm. He says, "Auntie, I hear you talking with Mom. Mom doesn't have solutions for your problem, but this book can help you."
That's great.
Wow.
And so funny. And, you know, and my sister is thinking, what's wrong with this child? Go away. But then I decided and opened the book and kind of just reading, like, let me read and just feel what it feels like. I don't know what happened. I opened Matthew 13.
Okay.
Where Jesus is talking about the sower who went to sow, and some seed fell on the road and birds ate, and some seeds fell on the rock, and we just didn't understand at all. We said, put that aside and let's just chat. So later on, I traveled back to my husband, and you know, my sister lived in Mombasa and I lived in Kitale. So that was a long bus ride.
Yeah, big difference.
Yeah, long bus ride.
I mean, you're talking a full day or something, right?
Yes.
Okay. Like 8 hours, not 10 hours?
More than 10 hours, because okay, you begin at 3 in the evening and you arrive 3 in the evening the next day.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
Big commitment.
So I arrive 3 in the evening and I'm very tired and I want to just shower and do some stuff, and somebody knocked on my door. And I opened the door and they said, "Can we have a minute or 5 minutes to pray with you?" I said, "Really? Sure, pray. I need that." And they came in. But I said, "Only 5 minutes. I'm tired. I just arrived." And these 5 minutes they asked for, they kind of opened the Bible where Jesus is explaining the same parable that I read with my sister. Now they were reading the explanation of the parable. But to me, they were preaching. And I thought to myself, am I not the seed that fell on the thorns, and the things of this world are like stuffing me up? And before I knew it, I was crying. As I cried, they asked, "Could you share with us why you are crying?" And I said, "You just don't know, but I'm just coming from a trip and I think I'm being choked. I'm dying because life is not what I expect." And they said, "Christ can give you life. He's promised the devil comes to steal, to kill, and to destroy, but he came that we may have life and have life in abundance." And that at that point, I just thought, I need this Christ.
Yeah.
So my life began to turn around at that point.
Wow.
Yeah.
How long were you married? Your husband passed away. At what year did that happen, and what were the circumstances?
This was in 1989.
Yep.
That I was led to Christ. But then I joined a good church and joined ministry, did ministry with children, Sunday school, finally became a women leader. My husband actually died in 2009, if that's the question you asked.
Yeah.
Okay. But then 2009 is quite a long distance between. Yeah.
And you had kids?
Yes.
Okay. How many kids?
Six in number, but five are alive.
Yes.
Yes. Mm. Two wonderful daughters and three wonderful boys. Mm. My firstborn is 33 now, and my lastborn is 19. And I'm a grandmother of two now.
Okay.
I can't believe you're a grandmother. It's unbelievable. You look very young, Patricia.
It is the grace of God.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about HIV. In Africa, this is something that has been known and been talked about. You are somebody who has HIV. Can you tell us how you are fighting that stigma? What is that stigma like in Kenya today? Can you give us some of the background of that?
HIV stigma, I would say, is something that it's growing. It has different faces. Because right now in Africa or in Kenya, let me talk about Kenya. In Kenya, I think HIV is now on younger people than adults, whereas before it was on adults, and now it's the younger people that are at risk, and the stigma has to do with who knows my status. It's not like it used to be before. Before, societal stigma was real. Somebody like me suffered great societal stigma, but that is now kind of down. Everybody knows that you can take care of yourself. People know how HIV is transmitted and all that. But the stigma that is real now is the self-stigma, which the person that has it. And I think that is why it is so much with the young people now, because the people who are born with HIV, those that were born with HIV and those that are getting it now, the younger people seem not to be knowing what to do.
Yeah.
Rather than us now, people who had it then, and we have grown to know what to do and how to go about it, and we are public with it. Now it's about somebody knowing it and the doctor knowing it, and that's all. Mm-hmm. So before, then it was different, because when you had it, it was like a death sentence. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But now people know what to do and people can manage their lives more. But it's a pity for the young people, because it is difficult to know who has HIV and who doesn't have HIV. And so the spread sometimes when people are young and they are irresponsible, and I really don't want to say the word responsible, because some of the young people are born with HIV.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Mm. Is it like, I was thinking we could talk a little bit, like, so how did you get into, or how does these life experiences lead you towards serving and the work that you ended up doing? How was the road of beginning that?
Actually, I would say serving God has given me the strength even to be able to be a fighter. Mm-hmm. Because I started ministry in Sunday school. And for me, the reason I wanted Sunday school, because I wanted my children to turn out different. I wanted a better life for them. But then I was given the role of a women's leader.
Yeah.
And at that point, I started getting women who are concerned about their spouses and HIV. That was in early 80s.
Okay.
No, late 90s.
Okay.
And that is when HIV was really becoming an issue in Kenya.
Uh-huh.
And so the many women that I was leading came to me asking me what they needed to do. And I was not, as the Bible says, my people perish because of lack of knowledge. I didn't have knowledge on HIV. All I had knowledge on was the Bible and teaching them the Bible and faith. And so in 1999, when I personally tested HIV positive, it was devastating.
Yeah.
What do you do when you are a leader who has been giving you the hope, the one that you have been looking unto, has something that you fear, something that everybody else fear. And so that was a very difficult moment for the church and for us and even for me. And the stigma then was terrible, real. I lost my job. My husband lost his job. Wow. Our landlord chucked us out of our houses. But my faith kept me on. I knew that... I knew that God was not going to let me just die and leave this family that I really wanted to be a different family.
Yeah.
I knew there was going to be a way out. And so my prayer life kind of helped me so much as I fasted and prayed, and always God led me into people, connected me with people who kind of just helped me move from one stage to another. Yeah. So by 2002, I spoke on the pulpit about HIV and AIDS for the first time on a Sunday service.
Wow.
I stood up and said, friends, HIV is preventable, AIDS death can be postponed, and we can do something about HIV. It's not a death sentence. And that marked the beginning of my ministry changing. People turned out into my house that evening. People who didn't want anybody else to know that they are HIV positive, but they are HIV positive, but they wanted somebody to confide in and somebody that could help them. And a ministry called Discover to Recover was born that very evening. Wow. Of 2002 when I shared my status on the pulpit. Huh. Yeah.
And what's the purpose, the aim of the Discover to Recover Center?
The purpose of Discover to Recover, or the goal, was to eradicate stigma.
Yeah.
And give people the right information that they need, and to make people know that if you know your status, you can recover. You can recover what is lost. If there is anything that has happened to you because of your HIV status, if there is any loss that you've lost. And this actually I brought from the book of Joel, Joel chapter 2, verse 25 to 28.
Yeah.
Yes, and so Discover to Recover started as a place where people could just come and find solace, hope, counseling. We would take the ones that needed treatment for treatment. And if they were chased from their houses, my house then would become a place where they could come and just stay for some time as they recover and go back to their homes.
And then that blossomed into you taking in kids. So we said that you had five kids. And it's far more than just those five kids. I've been there. I've seen them. How many kids are you up to right now?
Well, the number of kids have reduced depending. I no longer take more. I take a few in.
Okay.
Because we are considering space and all that.
Right.
But the 53 that I first had,
yeah.
27 are grown-ups, and four are married.
Hmm.
The rest are working and are able to rent themselves their own houses and provide for themselves as they wait on getting married and doing whatever they want to do in life. And I bless the Lord for that. But I have 30.
30.
The first kid, we actually picked the first kid because we wanted to thank God. When I tested my last born, whom I was expecting when I tested HIV positive, when my son tested negative when he was 5 years old, I was sick with the pregnancy, and the chances that this child was going to be negative was zero. So when I tested him when he was 5 years old and found out that he was negative, I wanted to say thank you to God. And that's how we started bringing in kids who are living with HIV. The others that we had were just children who are vulnerable, but the real... touch of children living with HIV or children that do not have anybody to take care of and have AIDS was when our son tested negative.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so is that primarily are those the kids that you bring in then now are kids that are either HIV positive or are impacted by AIDS, or they lost their parents due to AIDS or HIV? How's that work?
Most of the kids that I take care of are kids that are affected.
Yeah.
Or living with HIV and AIDS, yeah. Affected in that their parents have died.
Yeah.
They might not be having HIV,
yeah.
But their parents have died of AIDS, and they have been affected. They've been you know, nobody wants to stay with them. They have no place to go to. Those are the kind of children that I take care of.
Yeah.
But with the church being in the community, finally we began a church at the center where the children are. And with the church being there now, we are kind of bending towards, because there's a lot of where the center is a real poor place. And we are finding children from within the community who they are not affected by HIV and AIDS in any way, but they are vulnerable in that the kind of life they are, or the place where they are orphans left alone and they can't continue living. So I just extend a hand and help them within the community.
That's beautiful.
Yes.
How did you first get connected with Calvary?
Wow. That's a big time one. I got connected with Calvary in 2010, and my life was at a crossroad. My contract with the organization that I worked with was ending, and practically the ministry that I was doing with people living with AIDS was from the salary that I earned. I had never got funding from anybody. It was the salary that I earned, and I considered it too much to be my own. So my contract was ending in 2010, and I was devastated. What do I do with the center? What do I do with the people living with HIV that I'm supporting, the children that we already have? And a lady from Kenya who had come to visit and saw what I was doing and was trying to write my story, went up to Liz Gold, who is the global director.
Yeah.
And just said, I'm screening a story of a Kenyan woman and I wonder whether you could come and watch. So Liz Gold came and watched. And after the story was aired, a few questions were asked. And the one of the big questions was, now that you're losing your job, are you going to close the center? And I said, I'm not going to close the center, but I'm trusting God. The God who has made it happen will kind of open a door. And Liz Gold walked to me after that and just said, I'm from Calvary Church and I just want to give you my card. I don't know, your story has really touched me, but I'm going to ask the church if you can come and share with our missions team what you do. I don't know anything that I can promise you. I can't promise you anything, but I just want you to know that we would be interested in knowing what you do out there. So he gave me an appointment over Friday, and I came to Calvary on that Friday and sat around some of the missions team and shared what I do. And just like that, they said, well, as Calvary, we have missionaries out there doing different things, and we hear what you are doing, and we just want to trust God that He's brought you our way, that you can be one of our missionaries. Maybe we might send a team. And just like that, they took me up, and I blessed the Lord for Calvary Church.
Oh, bless God for you. You came and you were our missionary for VBS a few years ago. And I remember going out there with Ryan Rail. We traveled. It took us a whole day to get there. And we got there. But to just walk through and to see your life and how you live, you got up while it was still dark. You're cooking breakfast for all of these children. And then it was school time and you had this minivan. And I think we had 20 kids in there that you were taking them to school. You were getting them to school. And we got to just walk through, get to film and just get some pieces on your life. But you came and you shared your story and who you are and what's happening with these kids. And I think our kids were blessed, and my kids still talk about you and love you, and you're part of our family anyway. But what was that like? And so we did the Penny Project for that VBS.
Yes.
What was the outcome of that, and how did that bless your ministry and what's happening there even today?
Tremendous. Actually, the other day we were saying with my family, you know, God's ways are not our ways. Meeting Calvary just because we were on rental. You remember when you came, when you were filming?
Yeah, you were renting a
children,
building there.
Yeah, we were renting a building. But from the Penny Project that the children collected, and then the church kind of
came alongside
and matched what the children had collected. And we bought land after buying land with the money that the church matched the children's money, then we build 3 classrooms with the children, the money that the children collected. That was $10,000. And the reason we did standard classrooms was because we didn't want to waste the money on a temporal structure to move in and then later on pull it down.
Right.
But it's amazing. It's amazing what we can do together. So as I speak now, the children's first house is almost complete. It's very nice. The sitting room has the tiles. We put the ceiling board on. The walls are painted. We just have a few finishings to be done, and we are building the septic tank to be able to build the toilets in and put it, and then move to the next house. So,
wow.
Yeah, we are in our own. The farm has added up to 4 acres now. Huh. People have come along and added. Calvary bought 1.5 acres. A friend bought another 1 acre. And recently somebody bought a 1/4 acre. So we are sitting on a piece of 4 acres of land.
And how many people do you have working with you then? Because you're obviously not doing all this yourself.
Well,
or are you?
I mean, there's a lot.
Well, right? Maybe you're not right now because you're here in California.
Well, I want to say things have progressed quite well. Mm-hmm. And ever since I never did all these things alone, people that have helped with their HIV status came alongside sometimes to volunteer to do things like washing and all that. But the work of doing the fundraising is the thing that I can say I've done before Calvary came alongside me and Beth, a friend of mine called Beth. I've done that single-handedly. But when Calvary came in, it's been kind of
a partnership?
Yes.
Okay.
It's been a wonderful partnership in that as when he found me, I was doing hotel work. Actually, I was cooking very early in the morning. And the reason why I was cooking was to cook and go and sell.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
You're farming also, right?
Yes, cooking to go and sell, farming. And so Calvary coming alongside kind of reduced a little bit of my struggling so much. I still do that kind of work, but not as I used to do before.
And that's what I think was amazing, because I run a pretty busy schedule, but running around with you was exhausting. We got up early in the morning, but how spread out your life was. You would be working this one job to be raising funds, and you'd be feeding kids. You'd try to get kids to the school to change their thing.
Taking them to school. I'm trying to go and pick them back from school, bring them home, rushing back to the place I'm selling the food.
And I remember we went out to the farmland. You owned farmland, and all of these places were separate. And that's the amazing $10,000 and 4 acres, and all of that now is in one place. All the kids are there, and it's something that you hope long-term is going to be self-sustaining.
Yes, yes. My prayer is that finally we'll be self-sustainable. Mm. A church is now on the compound, which is also coming up so nicely, and the community is so much welcoming with the church. You know, we bought land at a very poor place, and we did it because we wanted to do ministry. Mm-hmm. We didn't want to be alone somewhere in a place in the middle of nowhere where we're just with the kids. And so with the church being there, it's another avenue to even do ministry better. Yeah.
You are known out there as Mama Sweetie. We can't stop talking to you until we know. How did you get the name Mama Sweetie?
Well, my firstborn was such a sweet child. And everybody called us Sweetie, Sweetie, Sweetie. Mm-hmm. And so finally, back at home, ladies are called either with their firstborn kids' names or whichever. So then I was called Mama Sweetie by everybody. And everybody still knows me as Mama Sweetie.
So you are the mama to Sweetie.
Yes.
Right? So that's great. Mm. Well, we love you. You are the reason that your baby Sweetie is so sweet. We love you, and we're thankful for our relationship and our partnership with you.
Absolutely. Can people come and visit you if they wanted to form a team to come out there and help out for a while?
Sure. People can come in. That's one of my greatest prayers.
Yeah.
That people start to come in. volunteer, come and see what we do and walk alongside us.
I know. I hope someone is listening and to this and is inspired by the work that you're doing and would even want to contact the Calvary Reach Department and talk to someone there about getting in touch to come form a team, lead a team, get out there and go help you out. So that'd be great.
You're welcome.
It might just be me. She keeps telling me I've got to come back. And
oh, yeah?
I feel ready to go. It's good.
You know, you just have to open up and allow other people to come with you.
There you go.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah, well, Matt, why don't you open up a little bit more?
I think it's a good time to end.
Surprisingly, a man that I've known for some years came down with his grandkids, the son and grandkids and their friends. And they actually painted our house. So there's a lot of work to do there if somebody wants to come and do missions.
Yeah, Matt.
Yes.
All right. When I have grandkids, I will be there. Just kidding. I will be there.
You don't have to have grandkids to come.
I'm coming. I'm coming soon. I promise.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much, Mama Sweetie, Patricia. We love you.
Thank you.
Thanks for sharing with us.
Thanks again for joining us on the Calvary Life Podcast. If you enjoyed our show this week, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening. If you want to learn more about Calvary Church or share any of your thoughts, check us out on our website at calvarylife.org or find us on one of our social media accounts. We're on Instagram at calvary_church, Facebook at Calvary Church of Santa Ana, and Twitter at Calvary Life.